You're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and I'm thrilled and delighted to have one of my favorite guests on with me today, Professor Evan McKenzie. Hi, Evan. Are you there?
Yes, I'm there. Good morning, Sue. All right. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good morning, everything. Good everything. Thank you so much for joining me. I know you're very busy, and I know that you've been darting back and forth all over the country.
Yes, that's true, but I'm glad to do it.
I'm really glad to have you, and so are my listeners. I know that. There's always a lot of excitement when you're on. We're going to be talking not so much about everything under the sun today, but I think we're going to be concentrating predominantly on gated communities and how that affects us.
I think that's one of the things we could go into in more detail.
Why are we? Are we gating ourselves in? Are we gating the world out?
Well, we're doing both. That's the nature of a gated community. I mean, it works both ways. The metaphor I like to use for this, or actually it's a real story, is Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Mask of the Red Death, where it's a story that takes place during the plague years in Europe, and this fellow named Prince Prospero has a what they call a castellated abbey, a big castle.
Mm-hmm.
And he invites 1,000 of his closest rich friends to wait out the plague years inside the castle. And the idea is that the plague can't get in. And the story ends up with, of course, the plague ending up on the inside.
Yeah.
And then there's no way to get out. Well, the moral of the story, I think, is that, you know, these walls work and gates work both ways. And to focus more specifically on what goes on in our society, what happens with gated communities is that people are expressing, by their purchase of a house in a gated community, they're expressing some sort of willingness to trade liberty for security. They're saying that they're worried about their safety, they're worried about these things that are going on in the community at large, and they're saying that they want to retreat into their gated community so that they will have a higher level of security than other people around them, and they'll be protected against all these threats that exist in the environment. And when they do that, there's a trade-off, because they are, in a sense, seceding from a lot of things, including liberal democracy. Because as we all know, these homeowner association governments in general, are notoriously illiberal. They're notoriously disrespectful of basic liberties that Americans take for granted.
I agree.
Freedom of speech and press and assembly and
mm-hmm.
and expression and privacy and the rights of property and all these other things. Now, the standard argument that is always made whenever I or you or anyone else says these things, the standard argument that people always respond with is, well, so what? Because a deal is a deal.
Mm-hmm. You agree.
These people signed a contract. And when
mm-hmm.
they signed the contract, they gave away their rights, and they knew they were giving away their rights, and they were happy to give away their rights, and they don't want their rights. So they shouldn't thereafter be allowed to complain that their rights were taken away from them. Well, you know, I've spent a lot of time and energy trying to deconstruct that argument, because I think that is a bogus argument. In the first place, most people, there's very limited choice in many cases of the type of housing you can get into. In a lot of the areas where you see this sort of thing, there's nothing but homeowner association governed communities.
Fairfax County is one of them.
Yes. And secondly, people don't read the covenants before they buy. Many cases they can't even get them. They don't even have them to read until the day of the settlement or closing. And even if they did read them, it's 200 pages of legalese, a boilerplate that they can't even understand. So when you put all this together, and other issues as well, like, for example, it's not just what you consent to in black and white. It's that you're consenting to be governed by your neighbors. That's part of the main issue here. And you're, in a sense, the law is saying you have consented to agree with the way your neighbors interpret and apply these statutes.
Exactly.
And often that means you are one board election away from being tyrannized and then being told there's nothing you can do about it. Now, I don't think people have ever been asked to give knowing, intelligent, written waivers to all those liberties and rights. I've never seen a development where they really did that. So, I mean, the lowliest criminal can't plead guilty to shoplifting without a written waiver that specifies every single right and liberty they're giving up, that's explained to them on the record by the judge, that it has to be explained to them by their attorney, and they have to initial or sign off on every single liberty, the right to trial by jury, confront and cross-examine witnesses, et cetera, et cetera. That's what we do for jaywalking, for shoplifting. But here we have people losing fundamental liberties in their home, and they've never knowingly, intelligently, specifically waived anything. Now, that's the standard argument that I've been making for, and that you've been, and other people have made for a long time. But then, you know, with the gated community, it really becomes more of a problem, because the advocates of this sort of deprivation of liberty, the industry and other people, come back and say, well, now look, in the gated community, this is different, because these folks really did want to be cut off from the rest of society. That's why they have the walls, and in many cases, they've gone ahead and put up their gate by voluntary vote of the members after the development was constructed. And, you know, it really gives ammunition to the people who are arguing that the folks wanted to trade liberty for security. So I don't know. I think really that the whole phenomenon is very troubling for a variety of reasons. That's only one of them, that it strengthens the argument of the people who argue this is all voluntary. And also, you know, when you try to make in court the argument, which I think needs to be made and is being made in the Twin Rivers case in New Jersey, that these things are the functional, many associations at least, are the functional equivalent of municipalities and ought to be treated as public actors should not be able to deprive people of certain basic rights, at least under state constitutions. When you try to make that argument, if you have a gated community and private streets and roads, it tends to strengthen, the other side's argument, because they will argue, well, here we have a place where the public at large cannot even enter. Whereas in the Marsh versus Alabama case, which is the famous company town case that the Supreme Court decided back in the late 1940s, one of the key issues was that the streets were wide open, that anybody could drive through it, that you wouldn't even know you were going into a company town. Well, you know, these closed-off gated communities physically, by their architecture, send a different message. They send a stay-out message. In fact, you can't even get in.
That's supposed to be. It's supposed to be worked that way, but apparently it doesn't. They're not as secure as people like to think they are.
True.
There's a lot of people who walk into them very, very easily.
Oh, yes. There was that series in the Palm Beach newspaper.
Right. Yes.
I think we talked about this on another occasion, where the reporters found it was actually quite easy for them to enter these supposedly secure gated communities. And as I recall, the two easiest ways to get in were to either pose as a realtor or to dress as a jogger and just run right in.
Well, a lot of people say that they jog right past. A lot of people, you know, the gates, sometimes just because you have a gate doesn't mean that it's locked. Quite often the gates are broken. The other thing that it seems to be doing is that it hampers and impairs emergency vehicles' access to people, so they just tend to drive right through those little, if you've just got one of those wooden arms that come down, they just drive through them, and these things are broken, and they sit around broken for ages and ages, and they don't get fixed. And it gets to be very expensive for the people who live there to keep doing this. The one thing that I keep hearing, though, Evan, is that it's a marketing tool more than anything else.
Yes.
The developers do this, and they try to sell security, basically.
Right. Well, I think that's true. Developers have historically found ways to sell things that really don't cost them that much to build, and yet allow them to sort of jack up the price because there's serving a certain segment of the market that wants something, such as when they used to put race-restrictive covenants on the property. Well, that didn't cost the builder anything.
That's right.
He just said, you can't sell this house to a black person or an Asian or a Jew or an Irishman or something of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And by tacking that on, they could say, well, this is, quote, an exclusive development. Yeah, well, it was. It excluded a certain groups of people. And, of course, all that is immoral and violates fundamental public policies. Well, now they can, with really, in most cases, minimal security measures, really minimal, like these little wooden arms you mentioned or the gatehouse that's never occupied. Just this little, I've seen so many of these just little gatehouses. They're not even really set up to be used.
Yeah.
They're just basically decorative.
Yeah. It's a gazebo.
It's a gazebo. That's right.
It's a gazebo at the entrance.
Yeah, a gazebo. I mean, and they put this thing up, and then suddenly it creates this, it puts it in the category, the market niche of gated community, and that means they can charge more for it.
Smoke
this is people buying the illusion of security, but I think a lot of people buy the illusion of security these days.
And yeah.
And, of course, now, after September 11th and after this whole D.C. sniper episode and other the great concern about terrorism generally, I mean, that comes on top of an existing terror of urban crime. You add all this together, and the market on the consumption end, the demand side, for security measures, private security measures of all sorts, including purchasing guns and everything else, alarm systems, the market just goes way up.
Yeah.
And this issue of being able to keep people out who don't belong in your community, who you don't know, or let's say keeping out strangers, which is really what gated communities do. I mean, that's the idea if they're functioning. You're supposed to keep out strangers. Everybody, the theory is everybody who's on those streets has been screened. Either they live there or they belong there. They have permission to be there. That's the presumption. And people find that an attractive thing sometimes in times like these because they think, well, this person won't be a killer, won't be a robber, won't be a burglar. And if they see someone walking down the street, presumably they know they've been screened. That's the theory. But in reality, to actually have that work, you need a lot more than a wooden arm and an empty gazebo. And you really need internal surveillance because there's different types of security. There's perimeter security, like the walls. There's entry control, which is the gates. And then there's internal surveillance. And if you look at the little data I've seen, I mean, hardly any, but what I've seen suggests that that you really have to have internal surveillance because the entry control measures just aren't that reliable unless there are human beings involved. And even if there are, usually people can find a way in.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, they usually have sort of walkways or they'll have a separate entrance where people can you know, the trades can go in, the gardeners, the delivery trucks, the mailman, UPS, and all of those. People just drive around to the other entry and they're in, or they'll tailgate behind someone who's going in and they'll zip through.
Right.
And if you have codes, there, you know, the codes are being handed out to people. Teenagers give them to their friends. Oh, you know, come and see me. Here's the code. Just punch that in and you're in, basically.
Yep. So ultimately, to really get the kind of security people feel they have been promised by all the marketing, the images, they really need internal surveillance. They need human beings monitoring video cameras and particularly roving patrols and alarm systems that come to some central location. And this stuff is expensive. This is a lot more expensive than the average person, the average, let's say, middle-class home buyer may realize. But if you don't have things like that, it may not amount to much. It's in fact, it can create a false sense of security. And some burglars, apparently, are specializing in gated communities because once they're inside, nobody can see them.
Well, you know, have you ever watched when they finally apprehended a crook and the reporters go after them and they start interviewing them? And they interview the neighbors and they say, hey, you know, what about this guy? Did you have any idea that he was a child molester, a thief, blah, blah? Oh, no, he's the nicest person. He's lived next door. He babysat my kids. He used to feed my puppy. You know, these are the nicest people, and they may very well be living right next door in a gated community. These guys have to live someplace.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility. That's the old mask of the Red Death Syndrome there, where the threat comes from inside.
Yeah.
It could be, yeah, sure, that's entirely possible.
But the scene you were describing before with all of the monitors and you know, all of the centralized cameras and where people, it sounds like a science fiction story. Some, you know, like one called Oath of Fealty, for instance.
Yeah.
Where you can't, that's a terrible way to live, Evan.
Well, it wouldn't, it's not for me. I don't want to live like that. I don't want my family living that way.
I don't either.
And we don't. I mean, and here's the funny thing is that a lot of these security measures are being put in place in areas where there's never been a significant amount of crime in the first place.
Yeah.
Whereas in neighborhoods like the one we live in Oak Park, Illinois, which is right on the Chicago border. It's right on the border of an extremely high crime area. We live a block and a half outside the Chicago city limits.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of significant amount of crime. I mean, it's a major heroin dealing area, the west side of Chicago, and gangs and everything else. But the funny thing is, there are all these middle class people and up paying, you know, $300,000-$400,000 for houses to live here.
Yeah.
And sure, people have individual alarm systems in some of the houses,
mm-hmm.
but you don't really see a high level of physical security. People
yeah.
don't have these. I mean, I don't know of any homes in this neighborhood that have these iron gates or across the front door that you sometimes see. Nobody's doing any of that stuff, and people are quite comfortable, I think, for the most part. I'm not saying they're not fearful of crime at times. They certainly are, but they're not paranoid. And that doesn't mean you won't get victimized, but it just means that I think in many cases the gated community mentality is just driven by almost a pathological fear. The level of fear is just so far in excess of the actual risks that it's really puzzling.
Is it people who don't really want to take control of their own lives? Is that the type of person who would move in, let someone else take care of me?
You know who's written a really interesting book on this? There's an anthropologist at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York named Setha Lowe, who you probably ought to have on your show sometime.
Okay.
She is a wonderful person and has written articles on the issue of gated communities, has studied them, and has a book coming out on this topic. I think it's called Behind the Gates, but it's coming out very soon. Setha, S-E-T-H-A, Lowe, L-O-W, Setha Lowe. And she believes that certainly fear is the driving factor here, but if I can paraphrase her argument the way I understand it, what they're really after is a sense of control. And it relates to what you just said. They want to feel a sense of control because their fear is somehow related to a loss of control over their environment, over their lives. And this gives them that sense of control. That's really what they're looking for. In other words, it's not necessarily directly, pragmatically about protection from crime. There are gated communities going up all over the world. And
mm-hmm.
I spoke at a conference this summer in Germany
yeah.
on this topic. And they're going up in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, huge numbers. I don't mean one or two. I mean huge numbers around the Moscow suburbs, all over Bulgaria, Sofia,
mm-hmm.
in Bulgaria, in China, formerly communist China. They're all over the place. I saw pictures of lavish gated communities, and also, I mean, for that I'm talking about places for the rich,
yeah.
but there are also new gated communities for the middle class.
Yeah.
Middle class.
Yeah.
And they're going up all, Brazil is in the midst, it's particularly the city of Sao Paulo, Teresa Caldeira, who's a Brazilian anthropologist who teaches at UC, University of California at Irvine,
mm-hmm.
has written about this. She wrote a book called City of Walls, about Sao Paulo. Everybody, from the top of society to the bottom, is putting up security. And the people at the bottom are gating their homes with just stuff they find in junkyards. Pieces of fencing.
Oh, we need a homeowners association. We can't have that.
Yeah, that's right. So Now, in Sao Paulo, there's a very serious crime problem. You can sort of understand it, why people are trying to do something.
Yeah.
The police can't protect them. But what's going on in the American suburbs is something quite different. It has to be explained by some kind of psychological dynamic here, because it doesn't make sense in terms of the actual crime rates.
Well,
I think there's some real serious problems here with this that it's creating. And it undermines a lot of the arguments for reform. Not only that, but, it's creating all these issues of secession, and I think it makes, in a sense, how many people outside a gated community are the least bit sympathetic to the people who live in them?
Well, they're not. I mean, what they're doing is they're withdrawing from society, I think.
Yeah.
And they're basically saying, hey, we don't want to have anything to do with the rest of you. We're going to go behind closed doors, and we're going to hunker down, and we're going to stay here.
Right.
And there was an article, a recent article, where this woman who'd lived in this house for years and years and years was watching this the subdivision going up, a gated subdivision, and watching the walls go up. And I think that she felt a little hurt that all of a sudden these people who are moving into her area just don't really want to have anything to do with her. She says, well, if they don't want to be bothered with me, then I don't want to be bothered with them.
Yeah, right. And then when the people living on the inside, the people living in the gated community suddenly discover that they're living in a banana republic, and suddenly they discover that they're being tyrannized.
Mm-hmm.
Then they want to reclaim all those liberties that they didn't seem to value as highly.
That's right.
And suddenly liberal democracy doesn't look so bad after all, and suddenly they want to go outside the walls and go to the court system and invoke the U.S. Constitution and all that other stuff that they didn't feel was good enough before. Now, I know, I'm deliberately exaggerating that. Because, a lot of times people just buy something because it's the easiest thing to find on the market. But what I'm saying is, that's the way they are perceived. That's the way an increasing number of people perceive them. I'm not saying I think that they should be dismissed that way. But they can be perceived that way. And it really doesn't help reform efforts, in my view.
Well, going back, I'm glad you came back to that, because I jotted down some notes when you mentioned that earlier. I didn't want to interrupt you. You know, when we came up, when the various states across the country started coming up with the disclosure laws, some people figured that that was probably not a good idea. I was not one of them. I very stupidly said, oh, give them the, if anybody looked at the governing documents, they'd say, to hell with it. I'm not moving in there. Well, I was wrong. But what this did, I think, was reinforce the other side. Because what they're saying now is, look, we've got disclosure laws, and we've given you the governing documents. You had every opportunity to read them. You agreed to them.
Right.
So it strengthened their case, and it seemed to me that the courts went from construing the governing documents in favor of the weaker party to looking at it more as a contractual agreement. Am I wrong there, or is it just...
No, I think you're absolutely right, Shu. You hit it right on the head.
And now when you're talking about the gated communities, obviously if you move in behind gates, then this is exactly what you wanted. So put up or shut up, right?
Yep. That's the way it will be portrayed. That's the way it is being portrayed. And, what needs to happen instead is that people need to, we need to make some changes to expand people's liberties inside and outside, and to reconnect the people living in homeowner associations, to reconnect them back to the larger polity, rather than promoting secession and this, well, you gave up your rights, so don't come crying to us, mentality.
With the people who would move in, with respect to the people who would move into a home or into a gated community, they're basically withdrawing from society, at the larger society. But are these also the very people who would be apathetic and would do very little to try to make amends or change or reform or anything else?
Well, I don't know. Again, we get to the question of the difference between perceptions and realities. I think that, as I said earlier, there's a lot of problems with the assumptions that the law makes about the people who move into these developments. Here's what I see as the big picture here.
Okay.
I don't think gated communities should be looked at as a distinctly separate way of life that is apart from other homeowner association life. They're different physically, but they're institutionally very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real core issue here, and it was raised in some of the letters or the emails that you forwarded to me from your listeners.
Yes.
And one of them was this question of why, how to begin a national organization to address homeowner association issues. And that the person said that he had been met with complete apathy.
Yes.
In trying to do this. Well, I've been involved several times with people who have tried to set up a national organization. Because the industry is organized nationally,
mm-hmm.
It's organized at the state level, and it's organized at the local level.
That's
so they're
right.
the industry is organized at all three levels of government. Now, what we have with the association, the Homeowner Association Owners Movement, is typically it's only organized at the local level,
mm-hmm.
and in some cases, arguably at the state level. I mean, obviously, the Maryland Homeowner Association has tried to address state issues, and
yes.
a few other groups have as well.
Yes.
But nothing at the national level. And I have to give a little political science lecture here about this, because I've thought a lot about this, what's going on here. If you think about it, there are four ways for citizens to participate in American politics. One is through voting in elections. Another is through being active in a political party or identifying with a party.
Mm-hmm.
A third is through participating in interest groups, like, you know, the National Rifle Association or the National Abortion Rights Action League or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the last is through participation in a social movement, like the feminist movement, the anti-war movement, or, in this case, the homeowner association movement, because that's what it really is. It's, at this point, it's a social movement with aspirations of rising to the level of being functioning and participating in interest group politics. Well, right now, look at it this way. At the electoral level, the movement has no clout because issues that you can vote on and candidates you can vote on have never been presented to people in any meaningful way. That is, there are no pro-homeowner association, anti-association candidates.
That's right.
And there are no referenda or issues that you can vote on, so you can't express yourself through electoral politics. If you go to the parties, neither of the two major political parties, and in fact, really, most of the minor parties, don't have much to say about this. They've never taken any coherent positions on it, with the exception possibly of the libertarians, who tend to favor this type of living, because they, even though I think, and I have lots of libertarian friends, and I think that it's a fascinating party, but I think they have, in my humble opinion, missed the boat here as to what's really going on. But in any event, that's another story. The third, so there's no way you can join a party and advance this interest in homeowner associations. Third, interest groups. Well, this is what people are trying to do with groups like MHA and different groups around the country, is function as interest groups.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that the resources on the other side are absolutely staggering.
Yes.
That you're up against.
That's right.
And interest groups have been surprisingly effective and can be effective in certain particular issues, but mainly, so far, where are they? They've managed to block things, but have only had sporadic successes in getting things passed on their own. And then the last way to participate is social movements. Now, here's the problem. And this is what goes to the problem here. People say, let's get organized nationally.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first, you have to be functioning as a national social movement, I think.
Yeah.
And why is that not happening? Why? And this is the problem. It is because most of the people, a social movement consists of three circles of people. One is the inner core of dedicated advocates, the people who are on the job and really serious about this, people like you and Fred Pilot and George Staropoli and all these other people who are really concentrating on this.
Mm-hmm.
And outside that, though, there's got to be another circle, and that is the occasional participants. The people who identify with the movement strongly enough to act, to do something when they're called upon to do it. To write a letter, to go to a demonstration, to show up and testify, to talk to the media. Those people have to be there. You can't have a small number of core activists and then and practically no occasional participants. You need a large circle of occasional participants.
And we're getting there.
So if the peace movement or the environmental movement calls a demonstration, it can't just be the few hundred people who give their lives to this movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be thousands and thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
And then outside that ring is the sympathetic public. And those are the people you're trying to reach through the media who are listening to you. You know, for example, the civil rights movement has always had a strong voice, a sympathetic ear in the public generally.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with homeowner association activists is this. I can symbolize it, give it to you in the form of a historical analogy, okay?
Okay.
Rosa Parks. If Rosa Parks had been satisfied, if she had said, look, all I want to do is have a seat at the front of the bus. And once I get a seat at the front of the bus, I'm happy, I'm going away, I'm not going to have anything more to do with the NAACP. Where would the civil rights movement be if their activists had been satisfied to get their own problem solved?
That's right.
Where would the feminist movement be if somebody said, well, you know, I got a job in a law firm, so that's it. I'm not going to participate. My problem's solved. And I could go on and on and on with this. No social movement can sustain itself if its occasional participant ring is comprised of people who only want to get their own problem solved.
That's all they understand of this. They bought into the concept that, gee, if I buy in a gated community, I'm going to be safer. And, you know, it's the board that's not allowing me to fly a flag that's the problem. But once I get that taken care of, then there are no more problems.
Right. And with an occasional participant ring like that, you can't have a social movement.
No.
So somehow the people have got to see this as a collective problem that they can't escape. And put an end to just by getting permission to put up their own bird feeder.
Mm-hmm.
It has to go beyond this.
Yeah.
And I get calls and letters and emails from people all the time.
Yeah.
And what disturbs me most about this is the incredible number of people who only want to get their own problem solved, and that's it. And I know that that's where it has to be, where it starts.
Yeah.
But where would the labor union movement be today if instead of going out on strike for better working conditions for all working people, et cetera, it was simply a matter of saying, well, hey, you know, I got my raise. I'm not paying union dues anymore.
Yep, I'm out of here.
There wouldn't be any union movement. There wouldn't have been any collective successes.
Yeah. Right.
And people have got to understand this. And that has got to be the role of organizers. You know, you have to explain to people why they have a collective interest. Because and it's a very hard thing to do, but it has to be done. Because there's not, you know, this is not something that's going to go away. It's not something people can just hide from, I think.
It's growing.
You bet it is, and that's where we get to this whole, I call it the micropolitics and the macropolitics. The micropolitics is what goes on inside the associations. The macropolitics is the big picture that association living is a part of. And those two things are connected. And this is what I think many people in the sort of occasional participant ring don't get. That there's a real connection here between what's happening to them and what's going on in the society at large.
Yeah, I think we're starting to get the message. Evan, can we take a short break?
Of course.
We'll be right back. Don't go away. And we'll talk about macro and microeconomic when we come back.
All righty.
Here on The Commons, I'm Sue Bartholomew, and on The Commons with me today is Evan McKenzie. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Sue.
You're still with us.
Okay, I'm still here.
Good. We were talking about gated communities in the first half and about getting organized at the national level, and these are all things that we need to do, and I think you've given us some excellent points and some great ideas. During, you know, off the air, we sort of talked a little bit about how new urbanism kind of fits in with the gated community concept. And you want to address that a little bit?
Yes, and in case people don't know what new urbanism is, maybe I could touch on that just a little bit.
Okay, yes, thank you.
New urbanism is an idea that came from architects. It's basically an urban planning idea that did not come from urban planners. It came from architects. There's a group of several architects around the country that are very critical of the predominant approach to land planning in American suburbs mainly, but to a lesser extent in cities. Mainly suburban planning is what they focused on. They're anti-suburb. And they believe that the creation of the post-World War II suburban ring of cities and unincorporated areas was a disaster, has been a disaster, and has caused this problem that they lumped together, well, a set of problems they lumped together under the term sprawl,
mm-hmm.
under which they include traffic problems, massive consumption of gasoline, social alienation of people from each other, political fragmentation, air pollution, just a whole host of problems that are connected with sprawl. So what they want to do is, and what they have done actually, is come up with a set of plans, thematic approaches to the design of communities that have people living in a different way. Now what they propose and what they are drafting and what is being built in a variety of places is a different type of planned community. And this type of planned community, a new urbanist community, fits certain descriptions. And you can read about it on the website of the Congress for the New Urbanism and see more of the details of it. It's almost like a religion. It's got these principles that go along with it. But in essence, what it amounts to is you try to build a smaller lot, suburban-style housing. The lots are smaller. The lawns are smaller. The setbacks from the street are shorter. The houses typically have some sort of porches or areas that bring people into contact, visual contact, and relatively close proximity with their neighbors. The houses are often right next to each other,
mm-hmm.
so that when you look out your kitchen window, you're looking right in your neighbor's kitchen window.
You can just reach over and kiss them.
Yeah. This is designed to force people into contact with each other. It's on purpose. They're trying to create community by design. And they're also trying to use less land.
Mm-hmm.
This is, of course, something builders love. I mean, builders love density.
Yes.
This is great. If they can get people to pay $400,000 for a smaller lot, they'd rather do it, you know?
Yes.
And there are other things that go along with it. But basically, they're trying to create something that looks like what they call the traditional town. They like to build a town center. They like to have people getting their mail at the same location so they run into each other. They like to get people out of their cars and walking around so they'll put they won't have big garages and people walking into their house directly from a door connected to the garage. They want people to park their car someplace and walk and meet their neighbors, et cetera, et cetera. So they're trying to create what they think is a traditional town. And they're very much against gating. In fact, I believe one community that was on the official recognized list of new urbanist developments was actually taken off it at one point a couple of years ago because they gated it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they're against this gated community idea. And, of course, they set themselves up as the polar opposite of the gated community.
Right.
Now, there's some things that I really like about this. First of all, they like to have mixed use and they advocate mixed income developments.
Mm-hmm.
That
exactly.
is, they would like to get people of different social classes living together. And they like the idea, for example, of having people live in apartments in a development that also includes single-family homes and commercial areas.
Right.
They will even go so far frequently as to put the apartments above the stores.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is all really kind of neat stuff in many ways, and a lot of people, I think, find it attractive. The other thing is transportation hubs. They like it possible to build these things around a train station so people can commute.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how can you fault this? How can you fault people building pretty houses, trying to promote a sense of community and so forth? And celebration in Florida is one of the shining examples of this. Now, on the other hand, they still all have homeowner associations. And some people, like, for example, Wayne Hyatt, who's, I think, the preeminent homeowner association attorney, tries to get them to think more about community. He tries to draw up CC&Rs that will actually promote a sense of community, a real sense of community. And I think some of the better attorneys and the better planners are aware of this issue. The importance of making the rules flexible, using what Wayne calls community guidelines instead of rigid rules, and, you know, and using some common sense in rule enforcement, trying to keep the thing functioning where people like each other.
But would that ever work, Evan?
Will it work?
Yeah, I mean, once you've given the power to someone to, you know, instead of saying, all right, here, you know, here's the rule, you're giving them the power and you're saying, hey, you decide. And I think the minute you give one group of people the power to make decisions and have control over your own wallet, your own checking account, basically, you're not going to have a community. Because a community, it's just, I don't think it's going to work.
Yeah, you know, that of course is the biggest question mark. That is, if you build in more flexibility for the association directors to make decisions,
mm-hmm.
do you not also increase the likelihood
mm-hmm.
that they could tyrannize the residents if they so chose?
Exactly.
So that's why I always say the picture's not complete without a Bill of Rights. I don't think that Wayne is against this idea, although he should speak for himself on this, but I know the case book on this topic that he co-authored with Susan French. Susan French is a law professor who has advocated expressly having a Bill of Rights for homeowner association residents, and I think that's what needs to happen. My view of it is, if we had regimes where you didn't just get 200 pages of boilerplate, you got no more than 10-page plain language explanation of the basic governance scheme, where it was clearly stated what you could and couldn't do, how much power you were giving up, what you were subject to, and what your rights were. That one of those 10 pages was a Bill of Rights. And people could understand it, that you could potentially hold these governments in check. But they have to know that there's some things they can't do. My view is, governments have to have affirmative limits. That's, to me, the basic premise of liberal democracy. There has to be an outer limit, or call it an inner limit, if you want to speak of it in terms of privacy. A ring around people. There has to be some stuff they just can't touch. You cannot have contracts giving neighbors power without limit. It's just, it's an impossible situation. It can never work.
How about adult supervision?
Wayne's idea could work, and new urbanism could work, if you couple it with affirmative limits on the power of government that are easily enforceable by residents without having to spend $10,000 on a lawyer.
And well, that was my question. Where, you know, how about adult supervision? And that's one thing that's noticeably absent in all of these things, because you get someone, and especially when you couple this concept with affordable housing, you bring someone in and say, hey, we're such wonderful people, we're going to make you homeowners. And in order to make you homeowners, we're going to just sell you some airspace, and then you're going to pay so much, and we're going to maintain the outside. We'll protect you. Maybe we'll have a gazebo at the entrance or whatever. And these people are being suckered into all of this nonsense, and then they're expected to hire an attorney for tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars to protect their most basic rights.
Right. Now, you know what the other cure for this is? This is what I've been thinking about.
No association. It's a great cure.
I don't think that's going to happen. I think that local governments, I've mentioned this before, I know, but local governments are, this is built into the structure of local government now. This is not going away. There's just no way. You'd have to completely restructure local governments all over the country. In fact, they're moving in the direction of doing it more and more and more.
Oh, I know. I just
don't see this abolitionist agenda as being realistic. I think it could have been done 20 years ago, but I think it's too late.
I think you can't undo the ones that are already there, but we've got to rethink what we're doing. We've got, you know, we can't keep going down the same road. It's a dead end, you know?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think you have to rethink. I think, first of all, there can be reforms put in place that affect all existing associations.
Okay.
Absolutely. But I don't think abolition's going to work. Now, but that's a bigger question. You know, well, maybe I'm wrong, but I just can't see it happening. I just don't think it's realistic. But here's the thing that I wanted to be sure to get in here.
Okay.
And it relates to what you're saying. What the great tragedy of homeowner association living is that you take an enormous number of smart, capable, educated people. I mean, some of these lawyers, doctors, the people who've called me, it's unbelievable.
Oh, yeah.
And you bring them in, and they end up spending all this energy and all this time
mm-hmm.
and all this money and all this nervous energy over some ultimately trivial issue.
Yes.
That is a tragedy.
I agree.
What has to happen here is that homeowner association residents really I think associations generally need to be built back into the system so that these people can devote their energy to something a lot more constructive than whether your lamppost mm-hmm. is in the right place or whether you can have a frog planter.
I know.
You know, or up all the way up to the dreaded pink flamingos. People should not be having to fight over this stuff in order to defend some notion of personal security and sanctity of their home. They should be concerned about their community, the bigger issues. And we got to we have to steer these associations and their activities in a different direction. They are way too inward-looking. The associations themselves are too inward-looking. And they're set up that way. They are designed that way. And so are American cities. American cities are also set up to be inward-looking, to be narrowly focused on what goes on within their own borders, and to not be concerned about regional problems.
So you're
they are rewarded for hoarding their own tax base, protecting their own borders, and obsessing about their own stuff. And in the meantime, most of the issues that affect metropolitan America are regional problems. Crime is a regional problem.
That's right.
Racial segregation and racial discrimination are regional problems. That's and on. Sprawl, air pollution, the unfairness of our taxing system, the unfairness of our educational system is based too much on property tax, et cetera, et cetera. These are all regional problems. And we've got, and I think associations could be part of solving these problems. And if they were, people would be a lot less inclined to obsess about trivia. And everybody would be happier.
I think that there's probably a way that we can separate out private from public spaces. And I think when you take private homes and throw them in the mix with, when I say public, I'm talking about common areas, and then put the Mad Hatter next door in charge of this. It's just, you're going to run into so many problems. I think what you're saying is pretty much what I'm saying in a different way, and let's redesign this. Let's rethink this concept. Maybe we can help solve the regional problems and solve the issues that the local municipalities are facing without resorting to what we have now, or what we commonly know as the homeowners association.
What we need to think about is not just what do we need to do to the associations, but how does the notion of a private residential government and a government that can collect assessments and spend the assessments for certain specific purposes, how does that fit into the overall picture? And how should cities fit into the overall picture? You know, there have been some proposals. Professor Gerald Frug at Harvard Law School has proposed, and I spoke there a few weeks ago, including talking about some of these topics that we're discussing here. We discussed in his class mm-hmm. at Harvard Law School. And he also teaches it with David Barron, another professor who also has ideas on this point. But there are new ideas being floated around the Legal Academy about what the powers of cities should be and how those powers should be organized. And I think maybe what needs to happen is for homeowner associations to be seen as part of that picture. They're
right.
part of metropolitan governance, and they need to be brought into that larger conversation. Maybe there's some things they can do and some things they just plain shouldn't be doing at all.
Oh, I agree with you. I agree. And that's what, you know, when I say we've got to, you know, do away with them, I don't mean do away with the existing ones legally, structurally, and all of that. And they're going to disintegrate on their own. They're not that well built. But I think we need to look at what we're doing and maybe redesign the whole system for future
ones.
Well,
you know, as you hit on the key question, which is the wearing out of these houses.
Mm-hmm.
The house that my family and I live in was built in 1927,
mm-hmm.
and it has foundations. It's a brick house, and it's a brick bungalow,
mm-hmm.
and it has foundations on it that you could probably support an office building on.
Right.
You know? This thing was built to last. But when I look at some of this new stuff that's going up in the suburbs, it looks nice on the outside, but I don't envision it being around
Matchbox
in the year
and scotch tape.
2102. I
yeah.
really don't.
Yeah.
I have no doubt my house is going to be around in 2027. I have no doubt about that.
Well, let's hope it is, because you know what they're doing in Fairfax County? Not only is everything that's being built right now being built in an association, but they're going in and they're tearing down the brick bungalows like yours that you're talking about and replacing them with sort of high-density condos, townhouses made out of old matchboxes and scotch tape. Because that's what fits into our plans now.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is very sad. I feel like crying when I read things like that. When you think of a nice
yep.
family home,
mm-hmm.
it's been around for 50 years or 100 years, and it's being torn down to make room for these cheap little things.
Well, you know, I agree with you. That's very disturbing. I don't understand how our land planning processes get turned over to these private developers. The idea is, you know, that the developers are supposed to be doing their job, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're supposed to be trying to make a profit. But we're supposed to have public officials making the decisions about public land use. And it has long been understood that even if land is privately owned, the overall question of how the landscape is going to look in general is a question in which the public is concerned.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I think many local government officials, and I'm not picking out anyone in particular, but a lot of local government officials seem to me to have abdicated this decision.
Yes.
When they turn it over to these associations, they set up these PUD ordinances that require the creation of homeowner associations,
mm-hmm.
and they basically just turn the whole thing over to the developers, and then they sit back and say, well, you tell us what your plan is, and we'll just say yes or no.
If there's an association, it's yes, and then that's an excuse to distance themselves from their constituents. And that's what's happening.
Uh-huh.
They don't want to be involved.
Right. They want a turnkey operation where they get all these new taxpayers, and they don't have to
right.
provide services, and they don't have to think it through.
Exactly.
And then we'll let the hospitals worry about why they can't get ambulances in, and we'll let the local sheriff's office worry about why they can't serve legal papers on people.
Exactly.
And so on and so forth. And they just sit back and then act like, well, they didn't do it. You know, we're not responsible. And it's totally irresponsible to behave that way.
I completely agree with you. It really frustrates me when I see the way things are being done and when I see the way the local municipalities are sort of washing their hands of the whole thing, and they tell you, if you have a problem, go to your homeowners association.
Right.
That's your first level of government.
But you see, that's what I was getting at, that unfortunately the way municipal law is constructed, cities are literally encouraged to behave that way.
That's right.
They're encouraged to worry about nothing more than protecting their own borders against annexation or encroachment from bigger cities,
mm-hmm.
Protecting their own tax base, and dealing with their own internal issues. And they're encouraged to just forget about all this other stuff, you know, the larger issues that they're really a part of. So there isn't anyone watching for the larger concerns that affect a whole region or a whole metropolitan area. There's nobody who has the responsibility. And one approach has been to say, let's have regional governments. But the push for regional governments is just going no place, because big city mayors don't want it. They don't want to lose power. And the suburban ring, they don't want to lose their autonomy. So nobody's really for it, except some intellectuals. But I think there is a potentially a new era of urban reform coming along. And this time around, homeowner associations, business improvement districts, all forms of special assessment districts, all these special districts and special purpose governments that have been created, transportation management authorities, they're all going to be seen as part of a new picture. And I really think it's coming.
I hope so.
It's all going to be rethought. So maybe the answer will turn out to be for associations not just the fact that they have their own issues and want to have their own movement, which they should, but maybe they won't have to do it all themselves, because there might be a policy window that may open up in terms of the more general question of urban governance. And that's kind of where I'm going in the next book I'm going to write after I get done with this one I'm working on.
What's the next one? Does that have to do with homeowner associations?
No, the one I'm working on now has to do with Oak Park and its policies of integration maintenance. And I'll be done with that one in the next few months, and then I'm going to turn to this bigger project, which is the whole question of not just homeowner associations, but all these various kinds of special purpose governments and how they fit into the status of cities in the American political system.
I'm looking forward to getting that. That would be great.
Well, I've applied for a sabbatical next fall so I can work on it, and hopefully I'll get that time to try to crank through this.
Oh, wonderful. That would be great. Evan, I could talk about this for... I wish sometimes I had 2 hours, but I don't. I want to thank you. This has been absolutely fascinating. I've thoroughly enjoyed having you on.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Sue. Always a pleasure.
And I hope you'll come back.
Oh, you can bet on it.
Anytime you want to come back, you're always welcome, Evan.
Thank you.
We're gonna have to go. I just want to thank all of you for joining us. Please plan on joining me.